slowly than on Earth. For such an effect to be observable, the surface of a white dwarf must possess a clock that is easily visible. Remarkably, it does. An atom of a particular element, such as sodium or iron, admits light of characteristic colours. These are unique to the element and are essentially its light fingerprint. Colour is merely a measure of how fast a light wave oscillates up and down. Such a regular oscillation is exactly like the ticking of a clock. And sure enough, when astronomers observe a white dwarf and the light coming from a particular element of the star, they find that it oscillates more sluggishly than it would on Earth. In other words, the clock on the white dwarf ticks more slowly. And that slowing is precisely that predicted by Einstein. Red light oscillates about half as fast as blue light. Consequently, the slowing down of the vibration of light shifts the light towards the red end of the spectrum. This is why it is called the gravitational red shift. And this red shift, or red shirt, as an article in the science magazine New Scientist once referred to it, is observed in other contexts too. For instance, when astronomers observe light from distant galaxies, they find that it too is oscillating more sluggishly than it would on Earth. This is the cosmological red shift, and it has the same cause as its counterpart on a white dwarf. When we see distant galaxies, we see them as they were when the universe was younger, because their light has taken a long time to travel to us across space. When the universe was younger, it was smaller. This is because the universe is expanding, its constituent galaxies flying apart like bits of cosmic shrapnel in the aftermath of the Big Bang. Distant galaxies therefore inhabited a universe where cosmic matter was squeezed to a higher density on average and had correspondingly stronger gravity than today. In such a universe, time flowed more slowly than today, according to Einstein. We observe this in the sluggish oscillation of the light from distant galaxies, the cosmological red shift. In physics, however, there is often more than one way to skin a cat. Another entirely equivalent way of viewing the red shift of light from distant galaxies and from white dwarfs is to say that, in climbing out of the strong gravity, the light loses energy. Since the energy of light is related to how fast it is oscillating, with high-energy light oscillating quickly, light that loses energy oscillates more sluggishly. It becomes red-shifted. The sound of gravity. There remains one prediction of Einstein's theory of gravity that is yet to be confirmed directly: gravitational waves. In the general theory of relativity, space-time is not merely a passive canvas against which the drama of the universe is played out. It is an active medium that can be warped by the presence of matter. In fact, it can be jiggled up and down, too, creating a wave that propagates outwards like concentric ripples on a pond. This is a gravitational wave. But space-time is not as elastic as the skin of a drum. It is a billion, billion, billion times stiffer than steel. This makes jiggling space-time to create strong gravitational waves very hard indeed. In practice, it requires some of the most extreme upheavals of matter in the universe, the merger of two super-dense neutron stars, or black holes. But significant gravitational waves are generated by neutron stars and black holes long before they coalesce into one object, in fact, when they are still spiraling together. In 1974, this permitted an ingenious and elegant test of Einstein's theory. American astronomers Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor discovered a system that consists of two neutron stars in orbit about each other. One is a pulsar, which, as it spins, sweeps a lighthouse beam of radio waves around the sky. By carefully observing the binary pulsar, or PSR, B1913+16, Hulse and Taylor determined that the two neutron stars are spiraling together, getting closer by about 3.5 meters each year. In the jargon, they are losing orbital energy. and crucially, this lost energy is exactly the amount Einstein's theory predicts they should be radiating into space as gravitational waves. For this indirect proof of the existence of gravitational waves, Hulse and Taylor shared the 1993 Nobel Prize for Physics. The race is now on to detect gravitational waves directly. In the beginning, people looked for them with huge suspended metal bars. The theory was that such a bar, when buffeted by a passing gravitational wave, would ring like a bell. But a myriad mundane terrestrial vibrations, such as waves sloshing on beaches thousands of kilometres away, can drown out such a minuscule signal. In recent years, the technology of choice has been the laser interferometer, which attempts to measure the deformation of space with rulers made out of laser light. Gravitational waves have the peculiar property that, as they pass, they simultaneously stretch matter in one direction while squeezing it in a perpendicular direction. Giant gravitational wave detectors, each with two perpendicular arms to detect this effect, have been built in Europe and the US. The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Observatory, or LIGO, for instance, consists of detectors in two different US states and has perpendicular arms 4 kilometers long. Physicists operating such detectors face apparently insurmountable difficulties. By the time gravitational ripples from even the most powerful astrophysical sources reach the Earth, they are enormously attenuated by distance. Experimenters are faced with detecting a deformation of space so tiny that it would change the distance between the Earth and the Sun by less than a tenth of an atomic diameter. Likely sources of a strong enough pulse are not only a pair of neutron stars or black holes spiraling together, but the birth of a black hole in the catastrophic collapse of the core of a star. The latter process is believed to occur when an extremely massive star detonates as a supernova. Although there is an enormous amount of indirect evidence that black holes exist, there is no direct evidence, because by their very nature they are very small and very black. However, in the formation of a black hole, the membrane, or event horizon, that surrounds it is expected to vibrate violently, generating copious gravitational waves. Crucially, just as the sound from a bell is unique to the bell, revealing its shape and size, the ripples in space-time spreading outwards from the birth of a black hole are expected to be an unmistakable signature of the event. The detection of the birth cry of a black hole will not only confirm Einstein's theory of gravity, but at long last will provide the definitive proof of the existence of black holes. The comparison of gravitational waves with sound waves is apt. For all of human history, we have obtained our knowledge of the universe essentially from light, our sense of sight. As far as the universe is concerned, we have been stone deaf. Gravitational waves are the sound of gravity. Once we detect them, we shall at last be able to hear the universe. Chapter 18. The Roar of Things Extremely Small. Atoms. A physicist is just an atom's way of looking at itself, Niels Bohr. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. William Blake, Auguries of Innocence, 1803. Richard Feynman was arguably the most important American physicist of the post-war era. He won the Nobel Prize for devising the theory of quantum electrodynamics, which describes how light interacts with matter, and in doing so, explains pretty much every aspect of the everyday world. In the Feynman lectures on physics, Feynman asks, "If in some cataclysm all of science knowledge were to be destroyed, and only one sentence passed on to the next generations of creatures, what statement would contain the most information in the fewest words?" Feynman answers, "All things are made of atoms." The idea of an atom has an ancient history. Around 440 BC, the Greek philosopher Democritus picked up a stick or rock, or it might have been a vase, and asked himself, if I could cut this object in half, then in half again, could I go on subdividing like this forever? To Democritus, it was inconceivable that he could. Sooner or later, he realized he would come to a grain of matter that could not be cut in half any more. Since the Greek for uncuttable was a tomos, Democritus called such an indivisible grain an atom. Democritus further postulated that atoms came in just a handful of different types, and by combining them in different ways it was possible to make a flower, or a cloud, or a newborn baby. By convention there is colour, by convention sweetness, by convention bitterness, but in reality there are atoms and the void, said Democritus. It was a remarkable leap of the imagination. The world around us looks bewilderingly complex, but this is an illusion, according to Democritus. Beneath the skin of reality, things are simple. Everything is made of a limited number of types of atom. Everything is in the combinations. Atoms, in short, are the alphabet of nature. Democritus was led to his idea by the power of thought. But atoms, if they existed, were far too small to see with the naked eye. It took more than two millennia and the rise of science before indirect evidence was found for Democritus's idea. In a steam engine, for instance, steam pushes with a pressure on its container. If the container is fitted with a movable wall, a piston, this can then drive machinery such as a spinning machine or a train. The movement of the piston can be explained, scientists discovered, if steam consists of countless tiny atoms, flying about randomly through space. Their ceaseless drumming on a piston, like raindrops on a tin roof, creates a jittery force, which, smoothed out, we observe as pressure. So many of the properties of matter, especially when in the gaseous form, can be deduced from the hypothesis that their minute parts are in rapid motion, the velocity increasing with the temperature, said the 19th-century Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. The relations between pressure, temperature, and density in a perfect gas can be explained by supposing the particles move with uniform velocity in straight lines, striking against the sides of the containing vessel and thus producing pressure. The behaviour of gases such as steam provides evidence of Democritus's idea that reality is composed of tiny grains of matter. But what about his idea that those grains also come in different types? Proof of this came from an unexpected direction. For a long time, alchemists hoped it might be possible to turn base materials such as lead into precious stuff such as gold. Not only did they fail, but they proved the opposite of what they set out to show. Some substances cannot, by any means, be broken down into simpler ones. In the late 18th century, the Frenchman Antoine Lavoisier guessed that such elemental materials are large collections of a single type of atom. Gold was an obvious element, but over the years, chemists, the successors of alchemists, discovered many more. Today we know of 92 naturally occurring elements, ranging from the lightest, hydrogen, all the way up to the heaviest, uranium, and we have even made heavier artificial elements, such as plutonium. By 1815, the English physician William Prout had noticed that most atoms appear to have a mass that is a whole number multiple of the mass of a hydrogen atom. This led him to propose that atoms are actually made of smaller things, hydrogen atoms. Actually, as the atom was systematically broken apart in the late 19th and early 20th century, it became clear that it was made of not one smaller thing, but three smaller things. Protons and neutrons are close in mass to Prout's hydrogen building block, while electrons are about 2,000 times lighter. The picture that emerged gradually was of an atom as a miniature solar system. At the centre, like a sun, is a tiny nucleus containing pretty much all the mass of the atom in the form of protons and neutrons, the exception being the lightest atom, hydrogen, whose nucleus contains only a proton. Around the nucleus, like planets around the Sun, there orbit electrons. The protons in a nucleus each have a positive electric charge, and they are matched by an equal number of electrons with a negative charge. In fact, it is the force of attraction between opposite charges that keeps the electrons bound to the nucleus. The planetary picture of the atom was deduced by the New Zealand physicist Ernest Rutherford in 1911. Rutherford's protégés, Hans Geiger and Ernest Marsden, had in 1909 fired subatomic bullets from the world's smallest machine gun, a sample of radioactive radium, at a thin foil of gold. The picture of the atom at the time was of a Christmas pudding, with electrons studded like raisins in a sphere of positive charge. This predicted that Geiger's and Marsden's subatomic bullets, alpha particles, would fly through the gold atoms as surely as real bullets would fly through a cloud of gnats. To the astonishment of the two young experimenters, however, one in 8,000 bounced back. It took Rutherford 2 years to deduce that, contrary to the plum pudding model, 99.9% of the mass of the atom must be concentrated in a tiny nucleus, which one in 8,000 alpha particles had hit and bounced off. One of the shocks of the planetary picture was of the incredible emptiness of an atom. A whopping 99.999999999999% is nothingness. If you could squeeze all the empty space out of all the atoms in all the people in the world, you could fit the human race in the volume of a sugar cube. The best image of the atom comes from the English playwright Tom Stoppard. "Now make a fist, and if your fist is as big as the nucleus of an atom, then the atom is as big as St. Paul's. And if it happens to be a hydrogen atom, then it has a single electron flitting about like a moth in an empty cathedral, now by the dome, now by the altar." The electrons whirling far from the nucleus represent the surface of the atom, where it makes contact with the world of other atoms. Their number, which is matched by the number of protons, therefore determines how an atom behaves. For instance, how it links with other atoms to make molecules. The lightest atom, hydrogen, has one proton in its nucleus and one electron circling. The second lightest, helium, two protons and two electrons. The third lightest, lithium, three protons and three electrons. And so on. The neutrons in a nucleus carry no electric charge and play no role in determining how an atom presents itself to the world. Instead, they act as nuclear peacemakers, gluing the nucleus together via the strong nuclear force. Without their stabilizing presence, the enormous electrical repulsion between protons would blast the nucleus apart. It may seem that, with the atom turning out to be made of even smaller building blocks, protons, neutrons, and electrons, Democritus's idea has gone out of the window. However, his proposal was merely that matter ultimately is made of indivisible grains, and it turns out that Democritus is right. The world is ultimately made of indivisible grains. It is just that they are not what we have chosen to call atoms. That is our mistake. The ultimate elemental building blocks turn out instead to be subatomic particles known as leptons and quarks. Quarks and leptons. In fact, normal matter appears to be made of just four basic building blocks, two leptons and two quarks. The two leptons are the electron and the electron neutrino. The electron is well known because most commonly it orbits in atoms. But the neutrino is less familiar, mainly because it is so amazingly unsociable. Although neutrinos are generated in prodigious quantities by the sunlight-generating nuclear reactions at the heart of the Sun, they interact with normal matter so rarely that they fly through the Earth as if it were transparent. In fact, about 100 billion solar neutrinos are streaming through your thumbnail every second without you ever noticing. 8.5 minutes ago, they were in the heart of the sun. In addition to the two leptons, there are two quarks, the up quark and the down quark. These clump together in threes to make the proton and the neutron, with the proton consisting of two up quarks and one down quark, and the neutron, two down quarks and one up quark. The existence of quarks was proved by essentially repeating Geiger's and Marsden's experiment of 1909, in which they fired alpha particles into atoms and saw that they were deflected by the atomic nucleus deep inside. Physicists instead fired electrons into protons. In experiments carried out in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the ricocheting electrons revealed the existence of three point-like particles deep inside, the quarks. Although physicists are now certain that protons and neutrons are made of quarks, bizarrely it is impossible to knock one out and create a free quark. This is because of the peculiar behaviour of the strong nuclear force that glues together quarks. Not only is it super strong, Newton was right to say the smallest particles may cohere by the strongest attractions. It gets stronger the further apart are two quarks. It is as if they are joined by elastic that resists more the more it is stretched. Long before two quarks are free of each other, the energy put into stretching the elastic is transformed into the mass energy of new particles, as permitted by the law of conservation of energy. Specifically, the laws of particle physics cause a quark-antiquark pair to be conjured into existence. Experimenters must now separate two more quarks, but in attempting to do that, they will create two more quarks, and so on. But how do we know that the electron, neutrino, up quark and down quark are really nature's ultimate indivisible grains? The answer is because of the Pauli exclusion principle. This quantum edict states that certain subatomic particles cannot share the same quantum numbers. In the case of the electron, this means that two electrons in an atom cannot share the same orbit and spin. This ensures that electrons do not pile on top of each other, which would effectively make possible only one kind of atom, rather than the 92 whose combinations create the variety of our world. The Pauli principle is a consequence of three things, one of which is that particles such as electrons are indistinguishable. If two things are indistinguishable, it implies they have no substructure. Otherwise, the arrangement of their components could be used to tell them apart. The point is that leptons and quarks both obey the Pauli principle, and the only way they can do this is if they are indistinguishable, that is, if they have no substructure and are truly nature's indivisible grains of matter. So is that it? Ultimately, the world is made of just four building blocks: the electron, neutrino, up quark and down quark. Not quite. There is a twist. Isn't there always? For some mysterious reason, nature has decided to triplicate its building blocks. Instead of one quartet of particles, there are three quartets, each containing successively more massive versions of essentially the same particles. So, in addition to generation one, which consists of the electron, electron, neutrino, up quark and down quark, there is generation two, which consists of the heavier muon, muon, neutrino, strange quark and charm quark, and generation three, which consists of the even heavier tau, tau, neutrino, bottom quark and top quark. Bizarrely, neither of the two heavier families plays any role in the everyday world. In fact, since it takes a large amount of energy to create them, they were common only in the super-energetic fireball of the Big Bang in the first split second of the universe's existence. When the muon, essentially a heavier version of the electron, was discovered in 1936, the American physicist I.I. Rabi said, "Who ordered that?" The same could be said of all the duplicates of nature's four basic building blocks. Who ordered them? But how do we know there are not many more than three generations of fundamental building blocks? The answer comes from a surprising place, cosmology. Between 1 and 10 minutes after the birth of the universe, the Big Bang fireball was hot enough and dense enough for protons and neutrons to run into each other and stick together to make nuclei of the second heaviest element, helium. Remarkably, this primordial helium has survived until today, and it can be observed throughout the universe. Astronomers find that it accounts for about 10% of all atoms. However, it turns out that if there are many more generations of neutrinos, the gravity of their extra mass would have braked the expansion of the Big Bang fireball, causing the universe to stay denser and hotter for longer, so that it cooked up a different amount of helium. According to calculations, a universe with 10% helium atoms is possible only if there are at most 3 or 4 generations of neutrinos. So, there may be a fourth, even heavier, generation of fundamental building blocks still to be found. However, most physicists would bet against it. With 3 generations of particles, it would appear that there are a total of 12 fundamental building blocks, 6 quarks and 6 leptons. This is not quite all. There are also the forces that bind together the quarks and leptons, for instance, that glue the up quarks and down quarks into triplets to make protons and neutrons. Force carriers. According to quantum theory, the forces arise from the exchange of force-carrying particles. Think of 2 tennis players hitting a tennis ball back and forth. As each player returns the ball, he feels the force of his opponent. Currently, physicists know of 4 fundamental forces: the electromagnetic force, which holds together the atoms in your body, the strong and the weak nuclear forces, which operate only inside the ultra-tiny domain of the atomic nucleus, and the gravitational force, which holds together planets, stars, and galaxies. The electromagnetic force is carried by the photon, the weak nuclear by 3 vector bosons, the W+, W-, and Z, the strong nuclear force by 8 gluons, and the gravitational force by the graviton, though nobody has ever detected a graviton, and a quantum description of gravity in terms of such an exchange particle continues to elude physicists. So now we are talking about 12 basic building blocks and 13 force-carrying particles. Is that it? Well, actually, there is one other particle, the Higgs boson, which was discovered with much fanfare by the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva in Switzerland in 2012. This is a localized lump in the Higgs field, a kind of invisible treacle that fills all of space and impedes the passage of the other particles, thereby endowing them with mass. Well, as ever, this is not quite the whole story. Surprisingly, the quarks inside protons and neutrons are relatively light and account for a mere 1% of the mass of normal matter, including you. This is what the Higgs explains. So where does the rest of their mass come from? The quarks are whirling about at close to the speed of light under the influence of the superpowerful strong nuclear force. It is their tremendous energy of motion that accounts for the missing 99% of your mass, since, as Einstein discovered, all energy has an effective mass. Ultimately, that energy of motion, and therefore your mass, comes from the gluon fields responsible for the strong nuclear force. So there you have it. There are 12 basic building blocks glued together by 13 force-carrying particles, with one extra particle connected to the field that gives all the other particles their masses. This quantum description of the fundamental building blocks and fundamental forces is known as the Standard Model, and it is arguably the single greatest achievement of physics. Its major deficiency, however, is that it describes only 3 of the 4 fundamental forces of nature: gravity, currently described by Einstein's general theory of relativity, remains stubbornly outside the fold. 12 basic building blocks plus 13 force-carrying particles plus the Higgs are rather a lot of fundamental particles. And in fact, there are more. Yet another twist. Each particle has associated with it an antiparticle with opposite properties, such as electrical charge or spin. A particle and its antiparticle are always born together, so the mystery is why we live in a matter-dominated universe. The best guess of physicists is that in the Big Bang, some lopsidedness in the laws of physics either favoured the creation of matter or preferentially destroyed antimatter. Incidentally, in addition to heavy particles, baryons, such as the proton and neutron, nature permits the existence of middleweight particles, mesons. Instead of being composed of a trio of quarks, these are made of just two quarks, a quark and an antiquark. So, to recap, there are 12 basic building blocks, plus 13 force-carrying particles, plus the Higgs, plus all their antiparticles. But physicists are always hoping to reduce the number. Ever since the late 19th century, when James Clerk Maxwell showed that the electric and the magnetic force are mere facets of a single electromagnetic force, physicists have been bitten by the unification bug. They are convinced that the four fundamental forces are merely facets of a single superforce, which reigns supreme in the high-energy conditions in the first moments of the Big Bang, and which, as the temperature plummeted thereafter, repeatedly split into the forces we see today. In fact, in high-energy particle collisions in the early 1980s, physicists actually witnessed the electromagnetic and weak nuclear forces merge back together into a single electro-weak force. Supersymmetry. In this spirit of unification, some physicists have suggested that the building block particles, which are known as fermions, are merely different facets of the force-carrying particles, which are known as bosons. A serious drawback of this elegant idea, known as supersymmetry, is that none of the known fermions seem to be the flip side of any known bosons. Undeterred, physicists have postulated that the supersymmetric partners of the known particles have very large masses and that current particle accelerators have insufficient oomph to create them in particle collisions. If supersymmetry is right, it will show that fermions are the flip side of bosons. Unfortunately, it will do so only at the expense of generating a whole host of new particles. The hypothetical supersymmetric partner of the electron, for instance, is the selectron, and of the photon, the photino. It might seem a high price to pay for unification. However, there could be a huge payoff. The reason is that there is yet another twist to the story of the ultimate constituents of matter. Dark matter. Embarrassingly, the stuff made of atoms, the material you, me and the stars are made of, and that science has focused exclusively on for 350 years, turns out to account for a mere 4.6% of the mass energy of the universe. A whopping 71.4% is invisible dark energy, but that is not important here. The key thing is that 24% of the mass energy of the universe is in the form of dark matter, material that gives out no discernible light and whose existence is inferred only from the tug its gravity exerts on the visible stars and galaxies. The identity of the dark matter, which outweighs the universe's visible stuff by a factor of more than 5, is a mystery. However, one possibility is that it is made of hitherto undiscovered supersymmetric particles. Supersymmetry is just a modern attempt to show that a range of phenomena is merely a presentation of different faces of a single unified phenomenon. The desire for such unifications, however, is on an inevitable collision course with Democritus's reductionist desire to show that reality is ultimately created by the permutations of a small number of basic building blocks. After all, if the reductionist program ever succeeded in whittling down the fundamental building blocks to a single point-like fundamental particle, how could it have different faces? A point-like particle, by definition, looks the same from every viewpoint. There is, however, one way to avoid the conflict between unification and reductionism, if the fundamental building block is not a point-like particle. This is the proposal of string theory. String theory. According to string theory, the fundamental building blocks of matter are one-dimensional strings of mass energy. These can oscillate like ultra-tiny violin strings, with ever more rapid and therefore more energetic vibrations manifesting themselves as heavier and heavier particles. One such vibration, for instance, would be the electron. The strings are hypothesized to be fantastically small, typically a million billion times smaller than an atom. Probing such a tiny scale is way, way beyond our technological capabilities. It would require a particle accelerator to boost subatomic particles to an extraordinary energy, since, according to quantum theory, the quantum wave associated with a particle is smaller the greater its momentum or energy. Ultra-high energy is therefore synonymous with probing ultra-tiny scales, which is why the ultra-high-energy Big Bang echoed with a roar of things extremely small. String theory has gained popularity because one particular string, a vibrating loop, has the properties of a graviton, the hypothetical carrier of the gravitational force. Thus, string theory automatically incorporates gravity, which has proved the most difficult of the four forces of nature to unite with the others. The major drawback of the theory, however, is that in order to reproduce the behavior of all the fundamental forces, a total of 10 dimensions is required, that is, 6 in addition to the 4 familiar ones. Proponents of string theory claim that the extra dimensions are not apparent because they are rolled up or compactified far smaller than an atom. String theory is a possible candidate for a theory of everything. Such a theory would explain all the fundamental building blocks and how they interact with each other via the fundamental forces in a single neat set of equations that could be scrawled on the back of a stamp, or at least on a postcard. It would, according to physicists such as Stephen Hawking, bring physics to a final and triumphant end. However, a theory of everything would not be what it is cracked up to be, and for two crucial reasons. The first reason is that the universe cannot simply be the inevitable consequence of a theory of everything. This is because a theory of everything, by its very nature, would be a quantum theory. In other words, such a theory would predict not what happens, but merely the chances or probabilities of different things happening. Every time an electron is faced with a choice of going to the left of an obstacle or the right of it, every time an atom is faced with a choice of spitting out a photon of light or not spitting one out, what it actually chooses is random. And this kind of thing has happened a myriad times since the Big Bang. The universe we see around us today is not simply a consequence of a theory of everything, but the consequence of a theory of everything plus a mind-blowingly large sequence of frozen accidents. Billions upon billions of other possible universes could have arisen, all from the same theory of everything. Ours is merely one, selected at random. Any entity in the world around us, such as an individual human being, owes its existence not only to the simple fundamental law of physics, says American physicist Murray Gell-Mann, but also to the outcomes of an inconceivably long sequence of probabilistic events, each of which could have turned out differently. The theory of everything, if we find it, will be a triumph of the human imagination, no doubt about that, but it will also reveal the limitations of the reductionist approach begun by Democritus 2.5 millennia ago. We shall know the basic ingredients for a universe and the recipe, and that will be a fantastic achievement, but at the bottom of the recipe will be an instruction crucial to the success of the venture. Cook for 13.77 billion years. The theory of everything has another limitation as well. The set of equations scrawled on the back of that stamp or postcard will describe how nature's fundamental building blocks of matter interact with each other via nature's fundamental forces. But it will not explain a newborn baby, or a Shakespeare sonnet, or why two people fall in love. How do these things arise? According to physicists, these phenomena emerge. Emergence. A characteristic of the universe, or at least our particular corner, the Earth, is that the fundamental building blocks combine together to make bigger building blocks, and these in turn link together to make even bigger building blocks, and so on. So, for instance, quarks and leptons combine with each other to make atoms. Atoms combine with each other to make molecules, including the megamolecules of DNA. Molecules combine with each other to make gases and liquids and solids and biological cells. Cells combine with each other to make plants and animals and human beings and brains. And human brains combine with each other to make a global technological civilization. It is characteristic of this hierarchy, which spawns ever more novelty and complexity, that the laws that orchestrate how the building blocks at one level interact with each other give no hint of the laws that govern the behavior of the building blocks at the next highest level, and so on. Life is not found in atoms or molecules or genes as such, but in organization, according to the American biologist Edwin Grant Conklin, not in symbiosis, but in synthesis. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. For instance, a knowledge of how quarks glue themselves together to make the nuclei of atoms tells a chemist nothing about the behavior of how atoms link together to make molecules, and a knowledge of how a single cell works tells a neuroscientist nothing about how 100 billion cells work in concert to make a human brain that can laugh, conceive a plan to send a man to the moon, or paint the Mona Lisa. This is why, despite the fundamental status of physics, sitting at the bottom of the explanatory hierarchy of the world, it has not made redundant chemists or biologists or sociologists. At each level of complexity, new phenomena, described by new laws, emerge from the interaction of the building blocks at the level beneath. So, for instance, when large numbers of water molecules come together to make a water droplet, there emerges a property called wetness, which makes no sense for a single molecule of H2O. And when large numbers of atoms come together to make a pot of paint, there emerges a property called color, which makes no sense for a single molecule of paint pigment. Emergence might seem like magic, but really it is not. Nothing is being added. It is more that information is being thrown away. Although it might be perfectly possible to predict the motion of a single molecule of gas flying through space, it is impossible to keep track of the countless quadrillions of gas atoms that make up the entire gas. So physicists ignore a vast amount of information. They approximate. They clear out some of those irrelevant details so that they can zoom out and see the big picture. This involves them inventing quantities such as pressure and temperature, which are averages of the behavior of vast numbers of microscopic constituents. It is only when they zoom out intelligently in this way that we are able to spot correlations between the averaged out parameters, new laws that govern their behavior. The world of the quark has everything to do with a jaguar circling in the night, wrote the Chinese-American poet Arthur Tsai. But in practice, connecting the two in a single explanatory framework is way beyond our 21st century capabilities. We approximate because we do not have the mathematical ability to explain everything in terms of the behavior of the most fundamental building blocks. And we pile approximation upon approximation, and out of this process there emerge new laws, ever more approximate laws. This is how we understand the universe. This is how we make sense of a world that is far too complicated to be perceived in its entirety by the 3-pound lump of jelly and water that constitutes our puny ape brain. As Thomas Carlyle said, "I don't pretend to understand the universe. It's a great deal bigger than I am. People ought to be modester." What all this means is that the theory of everything, if it is ever discovered, will not supplant all of science, though it will explain the interaction, the fundamental building blocks of the world. It will have nothing to say about flowers or sonnets or the chuckle of a newborn baby. Chapter 19. No Time Like the Present. Time.
"What day is it?" asked Winnie the Pooh.
"It's today," squeaked Piglet.
"My favourite day," said Pooh.
A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh. "I can't talk to you in terms of time. Your time and my time are different." Graham Greene, The End of the Affair. Imagine you look out of your window and see Normans, and behind them Romans, and behind them Egyptians. Crazy? No crazier than it is for astronomers looking out across the universe with their telescopes. The further away a celestial object, the further back in time it is. Light travels at about 300,000 kilometres a second in a vacuum, but if, instead, it travelled at a mere 100 metres a century, about a kilometre away you would indeed see William the Conqueror still invading England, about 2.2 kilometres away Publius Scipio still battling Hannibal and his elephants, and not far from the horizon, about 4.5 kilometres away, the pharaoh Khufu, still making his weekly inspection of the building site of the Great Pyramid of Giza. The reason all these events would still be visible is because, at 100 metres a century, the light bringing you news of them would crawl snail-like across the intervening distance. The point? Douglas Adams memorably observed, "Space is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is." What this means is that light, despite travelling 10 million billion times faster than 100 metres a century, nevertheless crawls, snail-like across the enormous expanses of the universe. Standing outside on a crystal-clear night, you see the moon as it was 1.25 seconds in the past. The nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, and you need to live in the southern hemisphere to see this, as it was 4.3 years ago. And the Andromeda Galaxy, the most distant object visible to the naked eye, as it was when our Homo erectus ancestors were first venturing out onto the African savanna 2.5 million years ago. With the aid of powerful telescopes, astronomers can drill back yet farther through cosmic time, revealing galaxies that lived and died long before the Sun and Earth were born. And out at the very edge of the observable universe, they can see the shimmering veil of the surface of last scattering, 13.8 billion years back in time, and the furthest it is possible to see with light. What all this demonstrates is that time is not what we think it is. Because of the finite speed of light, time is inextricably bound up with distance. Or, as Einstein said, "There is an inseparable connection between time and the signal velocity." As we look outwards from the Earth, we might think we see the universe as it is now, but actually what we see are shells of space at successively earlier times. Telescopes drill through the onion-skin layers of cosmic time just as archaeologists dig through the dirt layers of terrestrial time. Astronomers, however, have the great advantage that they can actually see the past, Although they cannot know what the universe looks like now, their compensation is that they can see the entire history of the universe played out before their telescopic eyes. In our universe, then, the concept of now is meaningless. It is impossible to know what it is like on Alpha Centauri at this moment, since the light, carrying news of the star system, permits us to know only what it was like a minimum of 4.3 years ago. The connection between time, space, and the speed of light is as true on Earth as it is in the universe. The crucial difference, however, is that terrestrial distances are far shorter. The light carrying an impression of the face of a friend you are talking with reaches your eyes in less than a billionth of a second. This is about 10 million times shorter than the briefest interval of time that can be perceived by your brain. Consequently, you notice no delay. The concept of now, which does not exist at all in the large-scale universe, is on Earth, in most circumstances, a very good approximation. We can all safely assume that we are living in the same present. Or can we? Relativity and time. According to Einstein, the finite speed of light does more than simply delay news of events. Light is the cosmic speed limit, and everyone, no matter what their speed relative to a source of light, measures exactly the same speed for a beam of light. This can happen, as Einstein realized in 1905, only if the space of someone moving relative to you shrinks in the direction of their motion while their time slows down. Einstein later generalized special relativity. According to his general theory of relativity of 1915, if someone is accelerating with respect to you, which is equivalent to experiencing stronger gravity, their time appears to slow down. For instance, when astronomers look out across the universe to a shell of space at an earlier epoch, the matter of the universe at that time occupied a smaller volume than today, simply because space has been expanding since the Big Bang. With matter more concentrated, the universe's overall gravity was stronger, and time flowed more slowly. With time flowing at different rates for people moving relative to each other, or who are experiencing different gravity, it is impossible for people to agree on what is past, present, and future. In fact, the concept of a common past, present, and future simply does not appear in Einstein's theory of relativity, our fundamental description of reality. The question, then, is, why do we have such a strong impression that it exists? The answer is that the effects of relativity on time are appreciable only if two people are experiencing markedly different gravity, or are moving relative to each other at an appreciable fraction of the speed of light. And on Earth, all 7 billion of us are experiencing pretty much the same gravity, and even when flying in jet planes, moving relative to each other at less than a millionth the speed of light. This is not true, by the way, for the global positioning satellites, with respect to which electronic devices such as mobile phones calculate our location on the planet. In their elongated orbits, they swoop down towards the Earth before swinging back out into deep space. This means that not only do they speed up and slow down during each orbit, but they also experience strong gravity close to the Earth and weaker gravity further away. As a consequence, the satellites do not experience a common past, present, and future, and this must be taken into account by the program that computes our position relative to the GPS satellites. Relativity, it turns out, is not such an esoteric theory. It is an essential part of our everyday lives in the 21st century. Still, we ourselves live our lives in the ultra-slow lane and in ultra-weak gravity, where relativity would appear to have few consequences. Appearances, however, can be deceptive. Relativity, it turns out, still has a trick up its sleeve, and it has devastating consequences for our concept of time. The map of space-time. Einstein showed not only that one person's interval of time is different from another person's interval of time, he showed that one person's interval of time is another person's interval of time and space, and that one person's interval of space is another person's interval of space and time.
From now on, space of itself and time of itself will sink into mere shadows, and only a kind of union between them will survive, said Hermann Minkowski, Einstein's one-time mathematics professor.
Minkowski's union is space-time.
The most important single lesson of relativity theory, says British physicist Roger Penrose, is that space and time are not concepts that can be considered independently of one another. They must be combined together to give a four-dimensional picture of phenomena, the description in terms of space-time.
As lowly 3D creatures, we are incapable of experiencing 4D space-time in its full glory. All we can experience are shadows of 4D space-time, as Minkowski put it. And those shadows, space and time, change their magnitude depending on how fast we are moving relative to someone else. We might think we live in a universe with three dimensions of space and one of time, but actually we live in a universe with four dimensions of space-time. And herein lies the devastating problem for our concept of time. Each of the four space-time dimensions has the character of space, which means that space-time has the character of a map, a 4D map, granted, but a map nonetheless. And just as New York, Los Angeles, and the Grand Canyon are locations on a terrestrial map, the Big Bang, the birth of the Earth, and the end of the universe are locations on the 4D map of space-time, along with all the events of your life. What this means, according to Einstein, is that the past, present, and future all exist simultaneously. Disconcerting as this is to most people, it gave comfort to Einstein when in 1955 his long-term friend Michel Bessot died. In a letter to Bessot's bereaved family, which they might not have entirely appreciated, Einstein wrote,
"Now he has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me. That means nothing. People like us, who believe in physics, know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion."
But if the past, present, and future are only a stubborn illusion, and in no sense do we actually move through time, why do we have such a strong sense that we do? In fact, why do we have such a strong sense that we are not only moving through time, but moving through it in a particular direction? Why do we experience the past as L.P. Hartley's foreign country? For a long while, even before the advent of Einstein, who threw things into sharp focus, this was a complete mystery to physicists. The fundamental laws of physics do not prefer any direction of time. The law of gravity, for instance, could equally well allow the Earth to orbit the Sun in a backward direction. Despite this time reversibility, we emphatically cannot live our lives backwards, going from grave to cradle, growing younger with each passing year. Yet, incredibly, there is no explanation of why we feel we are moving through time and in a particular direction in fundamental physics. But there is such an explanation somewhere else, in thermodynamics.
The arrow of time.
If you were to show a picture of a castle, and the same castle as a crumbled vine-covered ruin, you would know that the derelict castle came later. Castles crumble, they do not uncrumble. The direction in which things decay or become disordered is the direction we associate with the direction of time, and it is the second law of thermodynamics that provides this arrow of time. There is a simple way of seeing this. Throw the fragments of a broken cup into the air. It is possible that the pieces come down to reassemble into an intact cup. However, there is only one way this can happen, only one way a cup can be intact. Contrast this with the countless ways that the cup can come down in even more broken pieces. It is because there are overwhelmingly more ways that the cup can come down broken than intact. Overwhelmingly more disordered states than ordered states, that cups break and do not unbreak. This is why time flows forwards but not backwards. It is why castles crumble but do not uncrumble, why coffee left in a cup grows cold rather than hot, and why people grow old rather than young. And this is the way that the 19th century Austrian physicist Ludwig Boltzmann formulated the second law of thermodynamics, in terms of the number of possible ways in which the components of a body can be arranged and still be the body. There is only one way for an intact cup, but trillions upon trillions for a broken cup. If all outcomes are equally likely, therefore, it is overwhelmingly likely that a cup will stay broken, not leap back together as an intact cup. It is not utterly impossible. The second law of thermodynamics is different from fundamental laws of physics in not being cast iron, but statistical. But the likelihood is you would have to wait many times the current age of the universe to see such a bizarre thing happen. So even though our basic picture of reality, relativity, predicts that all of space-time is laid out like a map and nothing actually moves through time, the thermodynamic arrow of time explains why we experience time flowing remorselessly in one direction only. So what is the ultimate origin of the arrow of time? Well, clearly, the universe can get more disordered only if in the past it was more ordered. If it was already maximally disordered, it would have nowhere to go. So the ultimate reason there is an arrow of time is that the universe in Big Bang was in a highly ordered state. So, maybe at last we are getting somewhere in understanding time. Although the concept of a common past, present and future appears nowhere in our fundamental description of reality, relativity, we nevertheless experience them because we live out our lives in the cosmic slow lane and in weak gravity. And although relativity sets no direction for time, we grow old rather than young because the Big Bang was an unusual, highly ordered state. But actually none of this really explains why we experience a present, why we focus our attention on the information most recently gathered by our senses. Why do we not have a delayed present, for instance, and focus on information that was collected, say, 10 seconds ago? Why do we not have two presents and focus on data collected, say, 10 minutes apart? According to physicist Jim Hartle of the University of California at Santa Barbara, we are looking in entirely the wrong place when we look for an explanation in physics. Instead, we should be looking in biology. No time like the present. Hartle thinks that when life arose on Earth, organisms might have experienced time in a multitude of different ways. For instance, there might have been creatures with a delayed present, or two presents, or three presents, and so on. But imagine life for a tree frog with a delayed present, says Hartle. It sees a fly, it flicks out its tongue, but because it is using out-of-date information, by the time its tongue is fully extended, the fly has long gone. Handicapped in this way, sadly, the frog eventually starves to death. And this, says Hartle, is why we focus on most recently acquired information, why we have a now. Because it ensures our survival. Because all other ways of experiencing reality would have led to our extinction. Hartle therefore believes that if there are other creatures in the universe, they will experience time just like us. Mysteries remain. For instance, our belief that time flows cannot possibly be true. After all, If something flows, such as a river, it changes with respect to something, like a river bank. If time really flows, then it must flow with respect to something else. There must be a second type of time, which is nonsense.
Aside from Velcro, says American humorist Dave Barry, time is the most mysterious substance in the universe. You can't see it or touch it, yet a plumber can charge you upwards of $75 per hour for it without necessarily fixing anything.
Einstein's genius was not to get bogged down in what time is, but to stick to what we can usefully say about it.
Time, he said, is what a clock measures.
The great American physicist John Wheeler managed to encapsulate both Einstein's pragmatism and Barry's bafflement.
Time, he said, is what stops everything happening at once.
Chapter 20. Rules of the Game. The Laws of Physics. It is only slightly overstating the case to say that physics is the study of symmetry. Philip Anderson. Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? William Blake, Songs of Experience, 1794. The world is not without order. The sun comes up every morning, people grow old, not young, an effect always follows a cause. There is a regularity to the loom of the world. Nature uses the longest threads to weave her patterns, so that each small piece of her fabric reveals the organization of the entire tapestry, said American physicist Richard Feynman.